feature story about Kenny Kingman. I think Kenny took the paper over somewhere around 1927 or so. He certainly wasn't afraid to write the editorials. It seemed like he had a paper that was chock full of information and such. Did that weekly paper in those days have a significant impact on the community?
Well, yes, not a doubt. The newspaper history, as far as the town of Chelan is concerned, I would say that Kenny was the first person trained for the job. Most all county or local newspapers in the early days were run by printers, not people who had formal educations, not people who were looking at the program of the newspaper being the media of communication between various people of the community. It was a matter of getting out a sheet of paper with enough ads in order to keep the door open and to give some news. But Kenny was the first one and the only successful one, I think, because this was before radio, of providing the community with a good reason to take a look at the weekly paper, other than the advertising, to see how much coffee was going to be at Whaley's store.
We're talking this morning with Artie Garten, and that's a good point. Kenny was the first journalist to come to work here. We will be talking with Art primarily about his adventures as a county commissioner in the Depression years and the impact that had on the apple industry and other areas of local life as well. But we're going to take a commercial break first, and then we'll come back and do that in a moment. Thank you very much, Steve. And we are speaking this morning with Art Garten from the Crockery. Want to thank Art for coming in. Thank Dean Haggerty and the crew here at the Crockery for... They gave us our little brown pot of coffee again. We're all set up in camp and ready to go this morning. Art, maybe a good place for us to start would be, since we're going to be talking primarily about your involvement as a county commissioner in the area in the Depression years, how was it that you came to be in the political arena in the first place, I guess?
Well, I think, Scott, everybody has a responsibility to his community, and being a young businessman and being interested in developing the total economy of the area. You mentioned apples a minute ago, but we were really a four-type economy area in those days. We had still had some mining, and we had a lot of lumbering and recreation. We called it tourist trade in those days, and the apple industry. My starting in politics, I was shoveling the snow out of my driveway of my garage in early December 1931, and a fella came in and he said, "You weren't at the meeting last night, but we nominated you for the city council." And then 3 years later, I was elected county commissioner. And the real motivation, as far as I was concerned, to run for county commissioner was because of the Depression and all of its problems, the need for people to really go to work on programs, because government as we know it today, as sophisticated as it is and so forth, was very, very simple in those days. And the amount of government we had was very, very limited. And the need then was not concerned about problem we have like today of rolling back programs, that was providing programs. And of course the number one big problem for this community, and the reason I ran for county commissioner, is Knapp's Tunnel.
Okay. What about county government itself? Now, you mentioned that there were differences at the federal level, and I'm sure there were at the state. Was county government different? Was it a different job to be a commissioner then than it is now?
It certainly was. In fact, the big difference was that the county commissioners were the legislative body for the county. The responsibility for a balanced budget, the responsibility for administration of all of the departments, other than the elected officials, of course, who had their individual responsibilities, but collectively, we had the job to do. The difference between the federal government, which in those days was a long ways away, because the federal government had not yet, to any degree, started participating in the affairs of the county commissioners and the local people and their government. And the state government was still quite a ways away. And basically, the only thing the state government was involved with county government in those days was not money. It was basically trying to develop uniformity, in other words, standards, health standards, highway standards, and that type of thing. And the freedom of the county commissioner in those days, as far as involvement with the community, you didn't have to do all the advertising, hold all the hearings, have all of the public input, the time elapsed to make decisions and that type of thing. You were so busy with the job of government responding to the needs of people because of the Depression. The only people we really had to keep in close touch with was the prosecuting attorney and the judge, because after all, we did have some laws.
Yeah, I imagine you did. Okay, Art, what types of power did the commissioners have in those days? I mean, did you have taxing powers, that kind of thing?
Yes, at the time I was elected county commissioner, the first restraint on the county commissioners as far as taxing was concerned had passed just 2 years before that, when the 40 mil initiative was passed. In other words, it limited county government's revenue by about 32% automatically, because the amount that was being assessed by the counties across the board in millage in order to carry on their responsibilities exceeded the 40 mil bill by that amount. And of course, the first 40 mil bill was a very simple piece of legislation, but it was very binding. It provided that you could levy on 50% of the true and actual value, 40 mils any 1 year, and that was the limit from property, and that was the first time they'd ever had that. And in fact, that's the basis for the tax problem and the very involved financial situation as far as government being financed is concerned that we have in this country today, is the fact that people begin to revolt on raising all of the money on their property valuation. And then is when government started to reach out for new ways and new avenues of taxes. And that is when the people, after 2 years, in 1932 when the 40 mil bill went into effect, and then it was in 1935 before we first got what we call cash taxes. Of course, the county commissioners, that would be the 2% sales tax that was passed in 1935 session. And specifically for two purposes, one, and basically to make the 40 mil bill work, and 50% would go to the counties for whatever needs they would have, which would be similar to what they call block grants today. Mm-hmm. And the other 50% went to education, because the educational costs in those days was becoming a very large figure on the basis of the narrow tax base we had, which was just the value of property.
So your basic sources of income then in the mid-30s were the property tax and that 2% sales tax?
Yes, and the tax on inventory tax on each store's inventory at the end of the year, and a few other minor things, selling part of the driver's license fees, part of the highway, your automobile license fees, and other assessments of that kind.
Okay, talking this morning with Art Garten. We're speaking from the Crockery, and we're going to take a commercial break and come back in just a moment. Art Garten is with us. Art was a county commissioner back in the 1930s, a most interesting time to be one, of course, when the Depression was upon us. Art, now, when we talk with Commissioner Wall or any of the other county commissioners, and they tell us about their attempts to deal with the local problems, invariably, one or two or three or four state or federal agencies' names will crop up and the people they have to satisfy and that type of thing. Did you have that kind of a maze of work to go through from government agencies in your days?
No, Scott, it was just exactly the opposite. We didn't have any of them. Just to cite a few, for instance, Department of Employment Security, that now is a central place where people can go to try to find employment, where people go to file their unemployment compensation claims when they become unemployed. That agency had not even been conceived yet. In other words, the first attempt, that department was an outgrowth of a federal program that was passed in 1933. And the federal program that was passed in 1933 made it mandatory that every county in the United States would make an unemployment survey. And the outgrowth of that unemployment survey was that there was need for a department where people could be served as far as helping them find a job, and for people who had need for employees to work to go to get employment. And of course, it became a federal agency. A state agency set up on a federal basis. In other words, the federal government paid all the costs. The governor appoints the director, and each county and each locality has an office. And from that unemployment survey that was made by the counties went the full responsibility directly out of county level into federal level for purposes of financing and coordination to the state level for the purposes of operation of employment security. I could, the highway department in those days, the federal funds coming down from the federal government to the states for highways in those days was mainly for the primary highway system, which was a 50-50 arrangement. Half of the engineering cost and half of the construction cost. And as the, in those days, the county's participation in road programs up to about the time that I became county commissioner, and when the Depression came on, is when we started to get state, a good amount of state highway funds and federal funds for projects, and then eventually the establishment of the National Highway System, which was a 90-10 program of finance. The first federal money that ever come to the counties directly was for farm-to-market roads, and we really cashed in on that one.
I'll bet so. But you didn't have the large number of federal agencies or whatever to contend with, the regulations and such.
No, the need for the federal agencies, generally speaking, Scott, came out of the Depression. As the Depression came on, the inability of people to pay taxes locally, and when the Constitution of the United States provides that if a government agency at the federal level collects money and hands it down to the state, they shall supervise. If they had to use the word audit, we wouldn't have the bureaucracy we have today, but the wording is supervised. And as the state would then, in the early federal matching programs, all went directly to the states with, and the state set up a formula basis that would take the money down to the counties, and the responsibility locally for the programs within our jurisdiction, which in highways would be the county program, and in public assistance would be all the, what we call public assistance programs today and all of the ramifications of them. Social Security had not yet been passed, and the permanent programs had not been passed. We didn't have old age pensions. We had poor farms. We didn't have rest homes. All of these things were the responsibility of the county commissioner. In fact, I used to carry a voucher book in my pocket at all times when I was first elected county commissioner. And I which would give people a certain amount of credit to go to any store and get groceries or whatever their needs might be. Mm-hmm. In fact, the only type of public participation we had in those days is every county commissioner had people watching out for their neighbors to the point that those who would not look me up would get their help. And that was a lot of the people, about 25%, by the way.
Who were your fellow commissioners in the 30s?
Well, at the time I was elected, a fellow by the name of Dude Brown, whose father and my father were pioneers here in the county together. In fact, they were at one time in the logging business together. Was from the Leavenworth District, and a fellow named Ralph Dunning, who had come from Missouri to the state of Washington. His father was a minister and a part-time minister and a blacksmith, and he had spent all of his earning years and work in the fruit industry from Wenatchee, and I was from this district. And of course, the commissioners were the same then as they are now, elected on four-year terms, with staggering terms. But in those days, a county commissioner could only serve two terms. Now they can serve indefinitely, as you know. And it was in 1941 that that was changed, and that was one of the few times that the County Commissioners Association overruled me in the years that I worked for the County Commissioners Association. Was on that vote. We lost it by 3 votes, whether or not we should change the tenure of 2 terms for county commissioners to as long as you could be elected. I was for the 2-term limitation. I'm still for it.
In the 30s, we pretty well established that you certainly couldn't, as a county commissioner, wait for somebody else to come in and help you with the problems your people were having. The apple industry, as an example, was certainly having some tremendous problems because they even had some regulatory problems with how much lead arsenate they could use and so on. And I know that orchards were pulled out, that kind of thing. What did people locally do, local government, local growers? Was there an effort to get together and work out some kind of solution to some of those tremendous problems?
Well, this is an hour program, Scott, and I might just tell you a few things. The first advisory committee and the first planning council were the one and same people in Chelan County. We were one of the first states to have a planning organization. And the number one responsibility of that organization was to get us out of the depths of the Depression and advise the commissioners because of the formality, how we could do things to be sure that we were not getting too far astray from what was right. And the outgrowth of that organization was the appointment of a businessmen's committee of 15 businessmen. The county commissioners were the coordinators, were the spearheads, and as I said a while ago, were the legislative body of the county. And we were not responsible for all of the good things that came out of that program, but we were responsible for the starting of it and the financing of it. For instance, the Businessmen's Committee developed a four-point program. And the development of the four-point program was to help the apple industry with its problems, because in those days we didn't have the strong cooperative organizations we have now in the fruit industry. The grower was at pretty much of a loss to be able to protect himself after he delivered his apples to the warehouse. Mm-hmm. So out of it came a four-point program, and out of that came a lot of the federal programs, and out of that came a lot of the safeguards that we have now that makes the apple industry work. And to give an example, 28 states were commercially shipping apples in the early 30s, and that dropped to 14 states, and now it's back to a much larger number again. But apples, getting into the Depression times, in 1929 is when the Depression started, but it was when the 1931 apple crop was starting to be sold that we found out we were in the Depression, because it wasn't until then that the growers started getting back red ink for the shipping of their apples and get anything back for them. So the all of the confusion in the early days of the apple industry and everybody thinking the other guy was trying to get the best of it it was very difficult for the industry themselves to organize themselves and to get themselves out of the depths of the Depression as an industry. And the Businessman's Committee was the crystallization of the effort. And the Businessman's Committee was made up of people who had no apple orchards. Because in those days, every time the legislature met, every time the Congress was in session, and people were going up the ladder of government for help for the apple industry, by the time they would get to Olympia or by the time they would get back to Washington, D.C., there would be a stack of letters or telegrams or phone calls saying, don't pay any attention to this man, he doesn't represent me. So we had to develop an organization that would be representative of the community as such and not the individual segments of the industry. Mm-hmm. In other words, in those days we had many curbstone brokers, what we called curbstone brokers, fellows who would take orders, growers would go to the curbstone broker and he would in turn send out feelers to all of the agencies that might, American Fruit and all of the big companies that would buy apples all over the country. And one of the big problems in those days was the condition of the crop. If somebody had some apples that were breaking down in storage, he would go to 10 brokers, and the 10 brokers would go to a couple of hundred different market areas and try to sell this distressed fruit. And the net result of it is that they didn't get paid for any of it. See, because they thought, well, we got them where we want them, now we take advantage of them. So that, along with the horticultural practices you mentioned, the federal requirements because of Pure Food and Drug Administration was the agency that used to give us the bad time over sprays and so on and so forth. For instance, the thing that brought the head to the lead sprays was the apple industry was accused of a fellow dying because he ate apples that had lead spray on them. And it's true, he died of lead poisoning, but come to find out some 8 or 9 years after this had happened, and the Food and Drug Administration had made a lot of tests and a big deal about it, the guy had been a painter all his life. So in other words, they finally found out that a person couldn't humanly consume enough apples for the lead that might residue that might be on the apples to affect them. But
there's certainly no water-based paints in those
days.
That's
right. That's the answer to that. But basically, the county government was the one that was the closest to people, along with city government, and had the full responsibility because. It was less than 80 years ago that the counties used to send money to the state to pay for the county share of the State Department of Education, who gave the examinations for the school kids that finished the eighth grade and high school and so forth, so that they could be so-called accredited. Mm-hmm. Just think, it's only been 80 years. So this matter of funding was all local in those days, yeah. Until the Depression came. And then is when the state legislature first started getting into the so-called cash taxes, like sales taxes and that type of thing. And it, the federal government began to send money down in various capacities. And farm-to-market roads is one of the first ones. And the many, many programs that came out of the Depression to stimulate employment. For instance, give you an idea of how bad the apple industry might have been at one time. For 2 years in a row, the county commissioners in this county, because county commissioners were not interested in Red Cross flour, they weren't interested in so-called relief, so we would declare emergencies and give a small amount of money to the irrigation districts. And the irrigation districts would ask the growers to come down that wanted to and earn 50 cents an hour for 20 hours a week to get a little money for groceries until they could get their seed loan and then to get their bank financing and on to get their crop onto the market. We did that 2 years in a row. And a lot of you younger people raising apples today on $10,000 to $15,000 an acre orchards might let you know that there was a time you could have bought the whole Manson project for less than $500,000.
Yeah. Art, the the guests that we've had on so far this month have frequently mentioned that during the Depression there were a lot of orchards that were taken out, and I assume part of that was because of the coddling moth problem, if the orchard had been abandoned or something like that. But who was it? Who was responsible for deciding which orchards would be taken out, which ones would continue to operate, that kind of thing?
Well, the county commissioners, of course.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, we definitely had the full responsibility. That's a very interesting program, the four-point program that we were working on. And one of the big needs was, in those days, we were trying to market commercially about 7 types of apples. And it was not profitable. And it was a known fact that you couldn't ship any distance a product that was had the water content that apples do. People used to say, why do you put all that water into an apple and try to ship it all over the world to market it? Well, the fact of the matter is that when the Depression hit in the 20s, Scott, a 10-acre orchard would normally produce a good living for a family of 4. That was a rule of thumb that we used to have in those days. Then came the Depression. And the larger the orchard, the more of a detriment it was from the standpoint of being self-sustaining financially. So a lot of the big companies that had been developed began to break up and that type of thing. Well, the net result was we had a lot of varieties of apples growing that were not profitable. If the industry was going to survive, they had to get down to the facts of life as far as what they were producing would be marketable and acceptable. So that was one thing. The other thing was that the tough years, 5 or 6 of them in a row, had brought along a situation where the horticultural practices could not be carried out because the grower didn't have the financing. And so we had the bad infestation problem. So the legislature passed a law that said that the Board of County Commissioners, through the Horticultural Department, which in those days was a department of the State Department of Agriculture for the purposes of uniformity, but the real responsibility was at the county level with the Horticultural Department, the County Horticultural Department. And they would certify to the Board of County Commissioners if a grower was in a financial condition where he could not be financed, could not take care of his pest problem, and if he had varieties that were bad, and if he was in a position where he was not going to be able to compete in a commercial marketing program, we would serve papers on the person, and they had a period of time, which was very short, to do the job, or we would remove the orchards. And of course, along with all of these programs, when they're started and so forth, comes a lot of little funny things. And this was not funny at the time, but you get a kick out of it now. Down by Malaga, we had a certification from the County Hort Department to push out 10 acres of orchard. And the way they would do that, they would put stakes on the corners of where these property lines were, and the bulldozer would come by and push them out. And one time the fellow got on the wrong side of the stake.
Oh, no.
And he pushed out 10 acres of orchard that was not certified for removal. And it was the most expensive orchard that was ever raised in Chelan County. I'll assure you that, because we had to pay for it.
Oh, wow. I would imagine you had an irate phone call or two over that one.
Yeah, we had a lot of problems with it. Another side of the story that used to be very interesting as the county commissioner's concern, that is a long ways from his desk today, and that was the deer damage. Mm-hmm. In the early 30s, deer damage was a very, very substantial part of the problem. And then after we got the tree removal program going, and they started replanting better varieties and that type of thing, the deer were a tremendous menace. The legislature provided a small amount of money, for those days it was quite a lot of money, and the deer damage claim could be filed by the farmer who had could prove to the horticulture department that he had had tree damage by the deer coming into his orchard and eating his buds and what have you. And then the county commissioners would settle that claim on a cash basis. And this was one of the many responsibilities we had in those days that are all done by somebody else now.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting. A funny story came along on that one time. A fella came in and he said, I'd like to collect my deer damage claim. So we asked him where he lived, where his location was, and he gave us the location. The Hort Department went out and checked it, and the trees had been removed. And here this fellow, 2 years before that, had lost his orchard because of the horticultural menace he was to his neighbors, came in and wanted to collect his deer damage claim 2 years after his orchard was pushed out.
Art, there were some government programs, I know, that were enacted in the course of the Depression. I think it was the Regional Agricultural Credit Corporation, wasn't that what it was called, RACC?
Yeah. That kind of, what, the RACC was one of the four-point programs. So the programs that the committee finally came up with was orderly marketing, horticultural practices, good horticultural practices, adequate financing, and programs of that type. Now, the net result of those programs, as they were put into effect by government agencies at the request of the industry through the Businessman's Committee, brought about the Regional Agricultural Credit Corporation. Now, the Congress had provided a lot of so-called shot-in-the-arm programs. In other words, the seed loan, where all you had to do is go sign up. You could get $300 or $400, and you could get your crop up to a point where the people you were financing with, if it was a co-op or an individual warehouse, then they could go to the bank or the bank of co-ops. They could get enough money then to carry you on through. And that's the way the financing came. Well, the Regional Agricultural Credit was an elimination of all of those agencies from the standpoint of responsibility that they had been set up to do specific little jobs. Mm-hmm. The Regional Agricultural Credit Corporation came in with a blank check from the federal government. They could buy your orchard, and a lot of the problems in those days, when we held the early meeting, Scott, there's only two reasons that people were on the orchards. They had a wood pile, and that was the only... their home was there, so that was why they were there. So there was a great need for new people, younger people, to get into the orchard business. And many of the older people were very happy to sell out. So the RACC came in, and they would pay cash money for an orchard. Then they would select a grower. They would give him 100% financing, 100% purchase of his orchard. And he set up a repayment program to the government agency. And a sideline of that would be this. During the Depression years, of course, we ran way behind in county government. And we were just, in 1941, when I left office, we were just getting close to a balance. Shortly after that, when the RACC actually got operating, Chelan County ended up with a tremendous, some $800,000 or $900,000 surplus practically overnight, because every time the Agricultural Credit Corporation would come in and finance an orchardist, they'd pay all of his taxes, they'd pay all of his bills, they would put him on a sound financial basis, and then with the repayment going back. So the Regional Agricultural Credit money that came in under the four-point program that was sponsored by our original advisory council, and with the knowledge and the continual support, and as we've begun to get a little success, full support of the apple industry. So a lot of it, hardships were the result of it, but a lot of older people got enough money to carry them on through the rest of their life. They got out of the problems of having to operate orchards. Younger operators came in, better horticultural practices were developed. The curbstone broker disappeared because the marketing centralized in co-ops and fewer hands. And the purchasing on the other side also began to come down in the numbers of people. So the Agricultural Credit Corporation was really not just a depression pump priming program, but it was a good, sound program that put the industry back in a respectable position as an industry, and has made it what it is today, the forerunner of making what it is today.
Okay, we're talking this morning with Art Garten about county commissioner days for him in the 1930s, and we're speaking this morning from the Crockery, and we'll come back and speak some more in a moment. We are talking again from the Crockery. Again, our guest this morning is Art Garten, whom we want to thank for coming in. We have been talking about the apple industry in particular in the whole month, so we wanted to talk some about how county commissioners worked with the apple industry in the 30s. But Art, you know, we've been mentioning the orchards that were taken out. There were a lot of people involved in agriculture who suddenly weren't anymore. That meant, I would imagine, some type of public assistance program. What did you have in the way of that in those days?
Well, Scott, the apple industry we were just talking about, to be frank about it, in order to make an intelligible program for the listener, I would assume that we should take a half a day sometime and talk about the details and ramifications of the program. But basically, because of the pricing situation and because of the economic condition of the country, and apples, to a degree, believe it or not, are a luxury item. It was very chaotic condition, and it was very difficult. And out of it came a lot of very serious problems. And a lot of them didn't go away until World War II. But the ability to get the industry following an organized program was successful. And it did originate with the county commissioners, with the blessing of the people in the industry who were helpless to help themselves because of lack of organization and understanding and control. Financial situation, economic condition of the country created an unemployment situation that was very unbearable. But before we get into that, you want to realize that in the early days of the apple industry here, the pioneers, the people that came here under the state-financed reclamation districts, which is another subject that we could talk about for a long time, was the financing of reclamation districts in the early days of the apple industry. But the real basic problem was growers, until public assistance did come along and until programs did come along that would help people from the thinning, when thinning was over, until picking started and until harvest started and then on around, there was a lot of need for public assistance. And of course, in 1934, I was elected, I took office in 1935, and in order to start out on this public assistance thing, I might tell you that county commissioners were solely responsible for public assistance. And counties, within the counties, the cities were assuming some responsibility. And when I was on the city council, in the first years when we found out we were real in depression years and literally hundreds of people were coming through looking for jobs of any kind, we started one of the early soup kitchens of the country in Chelan. In the town of Chelan, appropriated $400 to buy 25-cent soup tickets to give to people to go down to a restaurant on the main street and get two meals a day. And then when I became a county commissioner, all of the assistance programs that were available to anybody were county-oriented programs.
Let me interrupt you here for a moment, because this is one that I haven't heard or seen reference to, I don't think, in the old papers, the $400 city appropriation. That 25-cent ticket was good for a bowl of soup, right?
Bowl of soup and a couple slices of bread and a cup of coffee.
Okay. Now, could this be redeemed at any restaurant in town?
No, we had one contract restaurant in one of the pool halls, and one across the street that's nearest now to Dale's Tavern.
Okay. Was that an item of controversy when the council passed it? Do you recall the council meeting?
No. Yes, there were people who wondered what we were trying to do. And there were people, there's a sideline, a kind of an interesting story about the early days of the people going through the country. Everybody was broke, and nobody had much help, a way of helping themselves. But there was an automatic system that grew out of it. And there's a lot of people that won't believe this. But do you realize that they had a system of marking a place where you could go knock on the door and ask the lady if she had something to do because you were hungry and you wanted to eat, and she would feed you? You know that the people traveling through the country in the early days knew by these methods who was the soft touch and who wasn't.
Was it just a sort of a word of mouth kind of thing when you
word hit, of mouth
land,
type of thing?
House there that
and it worked all through the country. One of the early days of the financing programs, when you see, the emergency warrant was the only way that the county commissioners had. In other words, an emergency warrant, the county commissioners would declare an emergency because when they made their budget in the previous October, they didn't realize that they were going to have to help finance the living costs of people that were unemployed. So they would not put any money in the budget, or a very small amount of money in the budget, and then they would declare emergency appropriations as they went along, depending on what their needs were on a quarterly basis. And the net result of that was the building up of a tremendous warrant indebtedness. And for instance, the figures are ridiculous, but to give you an idea, that in 1935, a fellow on the floor of the state legislature, when they were trying to get the sales tax passed to give some money to the counties for public assistance, said he was opposed to it because King County had 30% of the population and were 90% of the problem. In other words, people flocked to the cities because that's where the soup kitchens were and so forth. But the net result of it was that the reason I brought that up, you see how the thinking was, everything was local. There was no need established yet in any large degree for programs that would be the same in all 3,300 counties in the United States, which we have today as far as social programs are concerned.
Now, in this soup kitchen thing, $400, that's a lot of soup at 25 cents a ticket. But who administered the program? I mean, how did you get your ticket?
Well, the tickets were printed, and on a request basis, people would go to the city clerk, and she would do the best job of screening she could, and that's how they got it.
Okay, so it was a judgmental thing.
It was a judgmental thing with person that one person in those days working in City Hall, and it was just something they did along with their every day's work.
Could you get tickets for your whole family? In other words, they had a family.
Yeah,
there
was other types of programs too. You see, at that time, Scott, I'm glad you brought this up, because when this was going on, the Red Cross flour program, which was the distribution of flour and other very basic necessities, was done on a countywide basis and a decentralized county basis by volunteer people. And so the family need and people that were coming through that had a tent and were camping and so forth, there was a place down, it's now a part of Camel's Resort, a fellow named Charlie Clark, had actually had the flour there and dispersed the stuff. And it wasn't long after that until the counties developed in the larger counties, developed surplus commodity stores. And not only surplus commodities were bought by the federal government. This program started in 1932, 33. the federal government would buy surplus agricultural commodities and ship them around the to the states and decentralized to the counties and to the cities for the purpose of distribution. So that was the supplemental program, but basically the soup ticket program was for the individual. What we used to call the fruit tramp and the bundle stiff.
Yeah, okay. Now, you mentioned earlier in the program that when you ran for county commissioner, your primary goal was to develop a Knapp's Hill. I assume you mean the tunnel there. And that, too, would have had a great deal of interest, I'm sure, for agricultural people because the roadways have always been important to them.
Well, you see, the Knapp's Tunnel was the steepest piece of highway from the Mexican border to the Canadian border. The top steepest part of that grade was 14.6. And the maximum standard today for a hill on a highway is 6%. So you can imagine what it was like. And then it was actually a bottleneck for all of Okanagan County and all of the state and the people traveling through the country. It was a bottleneck, especially coming up, because of being able to get any size of a load up the hill.
Give me an idea. I have always said I was going to go follow the old Knapp's Hill road route, and I never have done it. I'm sure an awful lot of people haven't. We know where the tunnel is now, but at what point up there in those hills did the road go over the top?
You came along the riverbank on a practically a very narrow so-called double road. There was places for turnouts. And as you came over the railroad track, you went about 150 yards and made a right turn and headed up the canyon. You went maybe 250, 300 yards, and you made a U left turn and started back up the other side of the canyon. And then you come to another U-turn, which is about 55 feet lower than this end of the tunnel, or 60 feet lower. So then you made another very sharp turn and went up to where you would come to the road level now, which would be the top of the hill. But the real economic problem was that you just could not use trucks for heavy traffic, period. But before we leave this public assistance thing, just to give people an idea of what it was really like in those days, after I'd been a county commissioner about 2 weeks, the legislature had appropriated $20 million for the entire state to be given to the county commissioners to help them supplement their county warrant program. And in other words, you could put a little cash with a warrant to make your funds go a little farther. I went over to Olympia, and the old Capitol building that's downtown was the location of the State Department of Public Welfare. There were, on the third floor of that old Capitol building, there were seven people working, dividing this money between all of the county commissioners that came after it from the 39 counties for the state of Washington. So the welfare department in Chelan County, when I became a county commissioner in 1935, had 9 employees. And when I left in 1941, we had 17 employees. And in those 6 years, we went from a program of all categories of public assistance being one and same, voucher relief, to where we had old age pensions, where we had aid to dependent children, where we had all of the other categories of public assistance we have today, the basic programs.
Yeah.
We had money coming down from the federal government to the states. And just to give you an idea without getting into any more detail, the state budget in 1933 was $20 million. In 1935 session, for 2 year period, was $40 million. And in 1937, the budget was $80 million. And in 1941, The budget was $168 million. But during this period of time, the increases all reflected the participation of the federal government and the state. And in 1941, the responsibility for the public assistance program became a state responsibility, not a county responsibility. And the counties were expected to put in 4 and a fraction mills of their assessed valuation into the program for public assistance. So it became a state program. And I would venture to say today you probably have 75, 80 people working in the county welfare office.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, good point. There was some astronomical growth in government in those days. About Knapp's Hill, though, you say you went into, that was one of your primary goals, to get the Knapp's Hill Tunnel put in. Who came up with the insane idea that you could drill a hole through that kind of rock and do it economically and get the job done? I mean, there must have been people who said, that's going to be really hard to do.
Well, there were engineers, including the district engineer in our district, who thought it was absolutely stupid to try to think about it because of two reasons. The cost and lack of program to pay the cost. Now, you see, in those days, the county commissioner was allowed to assess the property for purposes of highways. 10 mills of the assessed property valuation of the county was the basic road fund. The gasoline tax that came down in those days was minimal because of the percentage of distribution was very small to the counties, and the state highway system was in its infancy. In other words, the state highway department, with, believe it or not, consisted of mileage-wise quite a lot of road, but on the basis of meeting the standard that had been set by the highway department and the federal government for these roads, I would say that 95% of it was under standard in 1935. Mm-hmm. So the big push was to get roads from point to point. So the cash money that was starting to come down and the project money on a 50-50 basis with the federal government, as far as highway funds strictly were concerned, was pretty much limited to state highway construction. The county roads, they had to rely pretty much on their 10 mills and on bonds, so bonded revenue. Now, to give you an example, Chelan County bonded for $300,000. Just listen to this closely. $300,000, and that built the first Wenatchee, the first steel Wenatchee bridge across the Wenatchee River that we now go over every day we go to Wenatchee.
When would this have been?
Back in the early 20s.
Okay.
And it paved the road to Cashmere. And it finished the road to the top of Blewett Pass.
That one $300,000?
$300,000 did that. To give you an idea, the first state money that was put on the road from Wenatchee to Chelan, Harris, the fellow that Arden Harris, or Meredith Harris's grandfather, took the contract to build the first road, county road, from Wenatchee to Chelan. And this was before World War I, for $15,000, and he gave him $1,800 back because he didn't need it. All right, now getting down to Knapp's Tunnel. The big problem, the need for Knapp's Tunnel had been well established. There was no problems of that. And it took the Depression to bring it about because it was one of the first major projects in this part of the state that was financed from various types of programs that were financed by the federal government to create employment and to help develop a strong transportation system. For instance, the Congress appropriated a large sum of money to eliminate gray road separations. So, in other words, I came along at the right time with the right program. And the net result of it was that we put several programs together, and I'll tell you what they were. Number one was the Great Separation Money. Chelan County's share of the Great Separation Money was $47,000. There's a provision in the law that the Great Separation Money could not be spent by the counties or by the state unless it was approved by the railroad company. Okanagan County's share of the Great Separation Money was $16,000. Now, to show you how the need for the tunnel was recognized as far as the areas are concerned, the railroad companies immediately started to protest our spending of the money for Knapp's Tunnel. And the reason was because trucks would be able to carry bigger loads and the railroads would be able to not be able to maintain the tonnage that they had at that time. And another thing, for instance, of the $47,000 that was Chelan County's share of the Great Separation Money, $30,000 of that was set aside originally by the county commissioners before in the planning program for the elimination of the problem at Cashmere. Because the highway came down the main street of Cashmere, which they wanted to eliminate. You had to go over the railroad tracks, go up past the sawmill and back on again. And we had eight or nine times we would cross the railroad tracks between Knapp's Hill and Wenatchee. So immediately we got $47,000 because the Cashmere people couldn't decide on where they wanted the state highway to go, over where it is now on the opposite side of the river from the town, or whether they wanted to come along the hillside going across the Monitor Bridge and up to a pass on that side of the river. So while they were arguing about that, we put the money on Knapp's Hill. I went to Okanagan County, and the county commissioners agreed. They said, well, if you can get a sign-up of the substantial people in our community to help us, we'll give you our money to put into the pot to help finance Knapp's Tunnel. So all of the fruit companies, and when the fruit companies got involved, the railroad company began to back away because there was a lot of supplies, like the hauling of apple boxes and things that had to be done by trucks that could not be done by railroad, that they began to back away on Knapp's Tunnel. So out of that then came an emergency appropriation for the alleviation of grade standards, illegal grade standards. In other words, a while ago I said 6% grade was the maximum that the state highway could have. In 1917, the legislature established the main state highway. In those days, the big push was on water level grades, which it still is to some degree with a piece of road that hasn't yet been finished down here. But in 1917, the legislature established the state highway on the opposite side of the river. So in lieu of construction, they had a provision that where county roads were going to someday be a part of the state system, or where the state system had not been built, the states could enter into agreements with the counties and do construction and maintain the highways. So the road between Wenatchee and Chelan, which was a county road, legally, was being maintained by the state. So the state funds coming down to provide for the standard of the road to be 6%, the grade level to be 6%, put this project in very high priority because it was 14.6 grade. That provided about $67,000. And then the legislature, the federal government, appropriated in 1935 a secondary highway system money. This was to provide feeder roads working with the mine to market, the farm to market road system, to develop roads other than the main state highways, which were highly traveled and too expensive to construct to the proper standards and maintained by the counties. So we got the legislature to Road and Bridge Committee to pass a resolution saying that they established the secondary highway system. They would move the state highway back from the Douglas County side of the river to the Chelan County side of the river, which made our project eligible for part of the state's $800,000 statewide appropriation. So the net result was that in the meantime, the road to Manson was one of the roads that would qualify for a state secondary system. We had agreed among the county commissioners that we would spend about $80,000 rebuilding the road to Manson. See, that road at that time was half paved and half not paved. And the reason for the paving was to have a smoother road to bring the apples down to the warehouse and to be shipped, because there's a lot of damage, rough riding, transportation of apples to the railroad.
So the half that was paved was...
We were going to have to cover with oil. And we had to do some realignment. We had to knock off a lot of Rocky Point and about an $80,000 project, which today is nothing, but in those days was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So we allocated the $80,000 that we would get from the second, that the state would get for the Manson Road. We put the county money into Knapp's Tunnel, and then we paid for the engineering, which cost $8,700. We did all the engineering costs, and we had state engineers working in the county engineer's office under the supervision of the district engineer to develop the plans and specs and so forth for letting the contract. We let the first contract, and the bids were all too high. We had about $250,000 put together for the project. We called for another immediate bid, and a fellow came in with a bid that was $24,700 lower than anybody else. And you talked about drilling the tunnel, and his method of drilling the tunnel is how he bid the project that low. And at the bid letting, everybody over in Olympia, the contractors all come around and were kidding him about his low bid and said if he ever needed a job, come see him, and when he went broke, was so forth. Well, how he did this, the plan, normal way, would have been to blast the hole through at about 10-inch diameter and use small gondolas, little railroad cars, to pull the muck out, and just like you would go through a mine. He conceived the idea of going through with a 10-foot bore and then cutting the boom down on a shovel and backing the trucks in and loading the trucks as they widened the bore to the 28 feet width and height, 24 foot height. To make the total bore.
So that eliminated
the cost of moving it out with the trucks was so much more economical and faster and better. That's where he saved the money, and he had a very profitable project. Now, we had a production credit, a PCA grant also for the